Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Chester Osborne of Darenberg is one of the wine trade's rock stars, known for his loud shirts, zany labels and Aussie sense of humour. I caught up with him to talk about organics and biodynamics, Grenache and Shiraz, Malaysian swingers and the Alternate Realities Museum inside the Darenberg Cube. Hi, Chester, how are you?
I'm great, Tim. How are you?
I'm very well. It's always lovely to chat to you. Listen, man, where are you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm over in the winery. It's about 6 o'clock at night or whatever, but we're just about to foot tread a heap of Pinot, actually, as soon as we get off this recording from you. But we're about 90% of the way through vintage, and it's a real pearler. Very beautiful wines, lots of colour, amazing fragrance, very mild conditions this year, lots of rain in winter and good spring rain. So yeah, we're really, really excited. We need a good year. We all need a good year right now.
I think we all do need a good year at the moment. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, but I mean, well, I can't wait to try those. Listen, so many things to talk to you about. You know, you're such a great communicator, and the stories, the amazing Darenberg stories. I mean, one of my favourites is that the bloke who was your great grandfather, right, Joseph Osborne, who founded Darenberg, or that wasn't called Darenberg in those days, was a teetotaler, right? I mean, anybody knows you will know that you're not a teetotaler, neither is your dad. What was a teetotaler doing buying a winery? Why did he want to own a winery?
I'm pretty sure he's a liar. he was from a strict Methodist family, and so his father, I think, was probably a teetotaler, and he would have liked him to be a teetotaler. But he actually also had a whole stable of horses and raced horses, which was very, very persona grata. Anyway, so he decided to run race horses under a different name altogether. So if you can lie about your name and all this racing, I think he was actually hiding money. He was actually a treasurer of Hardy's. He was the director of Hardy's Wines from 1881 to 1912 when he bought the vineyard. And so my guess is they were hiding money. Tom Hardy and him were his best mates with Tom Hardy. They were probably hiding money using the horses for it, because he was the biggest race stakes earner in gambling in with race horses in South Australia from 1900 to 1912. Tom died in 1912, so he got out of Hardy's then and bought the winery. But my guess is he drank heaps all the time.
So it's another one of those Darenberg stories that nobody knows if it's true or not, right? It's
kind of, exactly.
It's the legend. I mean, your old man Darry is one of the greats, you know, and he's still going strong. He's in his mid-90s. Is he still involved with the business?
Yeah, well, he still comes to work twice a day, lives on his own and drives cars still, cooks himself and whatever, and he's still got lots of stories, still enjoys drinking and mystery wines. He says, oh, I can't taste anymore, and then he still picks, you know, the option, gets it right all the time, and he says occasionally, I can't remember everyone anymore. And I'm going, well, welcome to the club. I can't remember everyone. In fact, I can hardly remember anyone. So, he's doing pretty well, actually, for a 94-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you guys always seem to have an amazing relationship. I mean, some father-son relationships, not just in the wine business, are tricky. But you guys, you just seem to kind of fire off each other in a good way. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's a pessimist, really, and I'm a complete optimist. And that actually works in business really well. So I'm sort of creative, and he's the nervous, like not wanting to spend a cent, which you would have heard many, many years over. He taught me that I really, really have to justify any money I'm going to spend and do, you know, cost-benefit analysis and whatever. So that was actually really good, and you always did five-year plans and whatever. So and in the end, when he said, oh, I'm not sure your numbers are right, he'd just wander off, and I'd just go and do what I wanted to do anyway. And so he eventually he'd end up saying, well, you know, it's all going to be yours one day, so if you stuff it up, it's your problem. But no, but in a really nice way. We always got on really well. He never raised his voice at me.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a lovely bloke. And he was completely self-taught as a winemaker, as many people were in those days. You studied at Roseworthy, you know, Australia's leading wine school. I just remember, you know, are your approaches to wine very different? Did you change a lot when you took over as a young man in 1984?
So I'd worked in the winery and the vineyard ever since I was seven. All of my holidays, I always worked everywhere in the business. So I knew it fairly well, but not really as a winemaker, of course, because I was just a cellar hand or whatever. And I worked a few other wineries in Australia, and I was Bryce Rankin, the head of the course, said, you should go overseas and work in wineries for years, whatever. And Dad said, well, if he doesn't come back home now, then there won't be a winery to come to. You know, 1980s was a really bad time. You remember the vine pool scheme where the government paid people to pull out vines in 1985? Well, that was a really hard time. So I came home, and Dad hadn't changed the winery away from all the open fermenters and basket pressing, because he thought he'd change it, and then I'd come home and want to do something else. So he said he just left it as it was. And I came home and I didn't really know what to do. So I just left it as it was as well. But he had made a lot of great wines through the 60s and 70s that had made a great reputation for Darenberg. And so I went, well, surely we can just work with those. And that's, we just made more and more of those. We've now got 200 five-ton fermenters, all submerged cap, all foot-trod once. Then, and all, there's 10 basket presses, so there's one original one there that was 200 years old, a French cop press, and then I bought a 100-year-old Australian press, and then I made 8 others ourselves, actually. And so we still do everything the same way, just with a bit more understanding in the vineyard. The vineyard's changed a lot with biodynamics and organics and everything now, but and then understanding in the winery as well. In many ways it's the same, minimal input, no racking, only sulfur oxide, that's the only thing we're really adding.
So all you've done is maybe clean the wines up a tiny bit, just make them a bit more consistent, really.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose I introduced oak and refrigeration and inert gas, and more monitoring, better equipment to use monitoring with, so you can check everything perfectly. So, I suppose you could argue clean them up. But one major change I did was the crusher. So the original crusher was an old beta crusher, the big paddles that fly around a million miles an hour and smash the grapes and lizards to oblivion. We've got a wine called the Lucky Lizard because the new crusher actually lets the lizards through and they come out alive. So this new crusher, Demise crusher from Burgundy, was the softest crusher in the world in the 70s. And we put it in the 80s and it was good, but it did break stalks and bruise seeds still. So in 2009, we got another crusher, a modified Velo crusher. And this was even softer again, and no breaking of stalks and a lot more whole berries. And we found it was even softer again. And so now I can leave juice in contact with the skins for an extra 20% longer. And I get to get the same amount of tannin, but I'm getting only skin tannin, not seed and stalk tannin. So the wines from 2009 onwards are even better again from the stage from the old beta to the demise. So, yeah, it's amazing what one little piece of equipment can do.
Yeah, I mean, I love what you've kept from the past, but also you've modernised it in a good way, I think, really.
Yeah,
listen, you once said to me, and you're certainly one of them, that wineries need personalities. You're a big personality, but you said, but they also need good vineyards. Like, in other words, a personality is not enough. Just tell us about your vineyards, because they're very special. Are they all in McLaren Vale? How many hectares have you got? And just how different are the terroir that you have?
Yeah, so we have 7 vineyards all in McLaren Vale. Adds up to about 450 acres. What's that? Nearly 200 hectares. They're mostly very old vines, with obviously Shiraz being the main part. But I have 37 grape varieties, so lots of interesting Italian and Spanish and Portuguese varieties that I'm playing around with. Yeah, lots and lots of great, great vineyards. There are 40 different geologies in McLaren Vale.
Wow.
But the best ones, the three that I like using the most, is a 56-million-year-old red, brown earth or grey earth on limestone, which gives really lots of structure. Or there's a sandstone geology, which is quite a bit younger, only 2.4 million years old. And that's usually sand on sandstone. But we actually have 4 vineyards with a grey loam on sandstone, very rare and really amazing. Sandstone gives you lots of tannins, lots of earthiness, a lot of wide-ranging tannins because of the it's a young geology full of other micronutrients in there. And it's very friable. And so, if you've got loam on top, you get even more earthiness and richness. If you've got sand on top, you get more elegance. So it's quite interesting geology. And then the last geology is a sand on clay, which is also about 56 million years old. It's got Blewett Springs, a little bit inland. And again, the sand gives a lot of elegance. The clay is quite hard for the vines to get into. So those wines tend to be more about perfume and really lovely fruits. But really old vines can get into the clay a little bit and do have a bit of irony, sooty-like character. So the 100-year-old vines have more of this irony, sooty, earthy character, which is really exotic and fun to hop into. Yeah.
I think I'm right in saying that all of your vineyards, both the vineyards you own and also the people you work with, the growers, are all certified organic and biodynamic. And do you think that gives you better fruit quality as a whole?
So certainly all of our vineyards, other than the old one that's in transition, but some of our growers are certainly not biodynamic or organic. Right. But it does, I think what's more important is the organic part of it is certainly a big step in that you can't add free nitrogen to the vineyard. And that's the evil monster for vineyards is adding any sort of fertilizer that's free nitrogen. It'll make them more vegetative, thinner skins, and thinner wines. And you really grow if you're fertilizing through drippers and drip irrigating, you're really growing the vine with like hydroponics, where it's not really using the soil at all, and then it doesn't taste it from anywhere. So then the biodynamics where, you're putting cow horns, filling them up with poo, burying it in the vineyard for a while, and then spreading it around the soil, that does increase the microflora in the soil. And so you do actually get a more activity in that area. And not cultivating. We don't cultivate because that was sterilizing the soil as well. We just mowed to reduce the competition. And now the vine roots are everywhere in the vineyard. In fact, I told my father I was going to give up cultivation, give up herbicides, give up irrigation, and give up fertilizers. And he said, well, we should sell the vineyard now while we get something for it before they all die. And I said, but, you worked the vineyard with horses, I said, back in, when he first started in 1943, there were no tractors. He didn't get a tractor for 5 years. And he said the horses could never keep up with the cultivation, 100 and something acres he had to do with two horses. And he couldn't, so weeds were everywhere. And he didn't have irrigation and he didn't have fertilizers. All the fertilizers were going to making bombs, through that period. And the vines all lived and he made lovely wines and whatever. In fact, most of them were being sold to Max Schubert in Grange. In fact, Max said before he died, said to my father, come and have dinner, come and have lunch with me. I want to talk to you and your son about what happened. He said, all right. And Dad said, well, Max, what's this about? I haven't seen you for years. We used to be really good mates. He said, I just wanted to tell you that out of all the bulk wine we always bought, Darrenburg was the closest to Grange. So I should have asked him, does that mean you put it into Grange? He wouldn't have been able to answer that. He wouldn't tell me. But anyway.
I mean, I think I once asked you how many wines you made and you said, looked at me and you said, I'm not actually sure. Yeah. I mean, is it part of you that you need to keep creating things? I mean, you said to me once that it helps to give you flexibility because you've got places to put different wines and different experiments and all these different grapes you've got. I mean, are you calming down a bit as you get towards 60 or are you still as creative as ever?
Oh, certainly not calming down at all. No, more creative than ever. I mean, COVID's been fantastic for that. Everyone's more creative nowadays. Not travelling for 3 or 4 months of the year has meant that I can be much, much more creative. And in fact, I'm finishing a sculpture or two a week nowadays made of junk art that goes into the Darrenburg Cube. I think it's somewhere around 76. But I know next week we've got another one coming out called The Innocent Weed. It's a really bad prickle. Actually, all our biodynamic range is named after weeds because, of course, you spend a long time out in the vineyard having to get rid of the weeds, so we might as well call the wine after a weed. And we've got lovegrass and witch's berry and this innocent weed one, it's a GMS. And actually, the headphones I'm wearing are from a sculpture because I had to go and find some headphones. They're from a glass head full of innocent weed burrs, which I was pulling off today. My fingers are sore as because it's really hard. And it sits on a big carboy, a big glass thing, and it's got boobs and all sorts of things full of matches. There's mass, like three, maybe 1,000 little tiny matchboxes in there, inside this glass thing, that, you know, because we're playing with fire sort of thing, you know. And it's got little arms and legs from dolls that I've broken off, and it's got these headphones, and it's got reindeer ears as well. So
I mean, how do you come up with all these crazy names? You know, the fruit bat, the hermit crab, the Malaysian swinger, the feral fox. I mean, does that involve a bit of weed, a different type of weed? I mean, how do you come up with these names?
I actually can't smoke at all. I find that don't actually hypes me up too much, and I won't sleep for days. So if I ever walk into a room and someone's smoking, I'll just walk out, because even just a little bit and I'll be hyped up for too long. So no, I definitely don't do any drugs other than plenty of wine, though. That's a good lubricant and mind bender. But I don't know, I've got 600 sculptures in process. But the names come from, it used to be never before 2 o'clock in the morning, but now it's really pretty much sitting on the toilet every morning going through the dictionary. So yeah, I hope that doesn't make the wine smell different. But the Swinging Malaysian was an interesting name that I came up with, because that's one of our amazing sight wines, a single vineyard wine. We do 20 single vineyard wines that are all components of the dead arm, so we keep like 6 barrels separate. And anyway, Dad used to call the block the Malay block, because he got these little tiny posts that were only like 35 mil or 35 mil from Malaysia, cheap as anything. And as soon as we started machine harvesting, they smashed the wall, they all broke off. And so I had to replace them with other ones. But it was planted in 1969. And apparently my father went to swinging parties, I found out, where you put the keys in the bowl, you know, and went home with whichever chick who got the keys, you know. So I thought, well, it's the Swinging Malaysian, planted in 1969. And it's surprising how much of that wine sells in Asia, because
I think that may be my favourite name, especially now I know the story. What a great story. Listen, let's get on to the wines. You know, you're mainly known as a red wine maker, and yet you make really great whites, you know, Chardonnay, Riesling, White Robe blends. Do you think they get the credit they deserve?
It is interesting that, yeah, most people talk about our reds, and I suppose it's probably my fault partly, because I'm quoted saying occasionally that white is like poor foreplay, and so but actually I do really concentrate on making some great whites, and we do win a claim, and a third of our production is white, so there are people out there who recognise them and love them, so we're doing really well. We make amazing Rieslings that will age for 50 years. Picked at only 10, you know, about 9 something alcohol and huge acid with a bit of residual, the Moselle style, yeah, and no skin contact, no pressing. So we've won trophies all the time in the aged Riesling class, international aged Riesling class, for the best aged Riesling in Australia, which I tell Peter Barry all the time from up in Clare that, you know, he's going to have to try a bit harder if they don't keep winning these trophies. The Hermit Crab is a very big seller of ours, is Viognier Marsan, and that's our biggest selling white wine, which is bizarre. But, you know, I put in a lot of Viognier back in the 1990s when everyone was planting red, when they thought, you know, the red wine boom was coming. Mm. But growers were saying to me, oh, we can't plant more red, we've got to plant it white. And I said, well, don't plant more Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon or whatever. Yeah, I reckon Viognier's got a good chance. And I'd said that for a few years, and then I thought, oh, my God, I suppose these people want me to buy the grapes, because no one else told them. I better add up how much we've planted. And we had 200 acres of vines planted, the Viognier, and we hadn't even made a Viognier to know whether it worked. And so it's lucky that it worked, but that's why that wine's quite cheap, because I have to sell it somehow. I've got to get rid of the volume. But it's a lovely wine.
Tell us a little bit about the contrasting personalities of Shiraz and Grenache. Do you love them both equally?
Look, I love all of my varieties. I suppose you couldn't say equally, like Montepulciano, it's only one vineyard, so I love that little vineyard. But you know, Grenache, we have 20 vineyards of our own and 20 or 30 growers, you know, so lots of little parcels. And yeah, I absolutely love eating Grenache in the vineyard and seeing all the flavors. And it transfers exactly what you taste in the vineyard into what you get in the wine. So you know exactly what you're going to get. It's really amazing. And I mean, that happens with all grape varieties too, but that crunchy, vibrant, spicy, gritty character that Grenache has when it's amazing is exactly what you taste out of the vineyard. And yeah, so it's beautiful. But the beautiful old vine Shiraz and all the different geologies and the way, you know, where they lie in the area where they're facing south and cooler sites. And it's all the old vines versus young. It's all really just so much fun. 76 wines I'm up to, as I mentioned, and it's nowhere near enough. But I do have there's about four more coming out. Say one coming out next week. But yeah, it's life's too short to only have a few children.
To only have one wine.
Yeah, or a few children or whatever. I call them children. Yeah, they talk back to me. They're unruly sometimes, and sometimes they're smooth and mellow and are very respectful of me. And sometimes they're a bit aggressive and talk back and fart in your face. You know, but that's what I'm
I mean, your most famous wine is probably the Dead Arm Shiraz. You know, it first made in 1994. How did you come to make that as a single wine, basically? Is it a single vineyard wine?
So actually the first vintage was in 1993 of the Dead Arm, but it was actually a Cabernet Shiraz, and it was just the best barrels of whatever happened to go into oak in the winery. So really, you're right, the first Shiraz and the way that we make it was 1994, where it was the best parcels of fruit that I could find, finished ferment in barrel. We weren't doing that before then, and not racked, and then the best barrels of the best vineyards. So that's really what we did. Dad said, you can't keep growing all of these vineyards of Shiraz, all these older vines, whatever, as Dead Arm. You'll never be able to sell it all. So I kept doing more and more and more, lots and lots of vineyards. That's why I released 20 single vineyard Shiraz wines. That's why we introduced the Laughing Magpie, which is our Shiraz Viognier, because we had the Footbolt, which is quite a lot cheaper and more widely available. But I couldn't afford to be turning all these vineyards into high quality, low yielding stuff and sell it at that price. So I had to have something in the middle. I had all these Viognier skins that I had to do something with. So we take out two-thirds of the juice for make the hermit crab, and one-third of the juice stays in the skins and is put into the fermenters with the Shiraz, fermented together, of course. And anyway, so that's really how these wines will sort of morph, and I justify another wine all the time. And all of my staff have always said we need to cull more some of our wines, the streamline process ones. So I said, well, which one do you want to remove? And if we remove it, are you going to make up that volume in any of these other wines? And no one's been able to convince me.
Tell us about blending, because you're a very, very good blender. Is it something you do on your own, or you do it with a team? Do you regard it as an artistic pursuit almost, this blending of parcels and grape varieties?
I think the whole of winemaking is very much an artistic thing. I mean, we use science to make the art. And I'm tasting grapes in the vineyard 4 or 5 hours a day, working out exactly when to pick them. You know, I'll go into vineyards maybe 5 times before we've actually picked it. So I'm tasting all the grapes. I'm tasting every ferment. I control every red ferment all the way through the process and work and taste it as it gets toward the end, work out exactly the tannin level. And then when they're in barrel, they all stay in barrel with no racking, no filtering, no fining. So really, we're really lazy winemakers. And then I taste every barrel, 200 barrels a day, all just lined up. They're all just lined up in my tasting room, which is actually right next to where I'm sitting, funnily enough. And I start, you know, they get poured at 8:30 in the morning, and I start tasting at about 10:30. So I like them to breathe. So anything that was a little bit riper will start falling over. Anything that's tight will start opening up. And then I'll finish at about 1:30, so it's about 3 hours of going through every barrel and working out where it's going to go. And then I invite my other winemakers in and the vineyard manager, and we look at one or two barrels of each group, and we talk about what's happened in that vineyard and why it is the way it is, and that's it really. And so I decide where every barrel goes. 10,000 barrels, so it's quite a few months of blending.
That's a lot of tasting every morning, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it means I'm never sober. Yeah, I'm just topping up for the night before, and then it's all good.
That explains everything, right? I mean, tell us about Cabernet, because Cabernet has always been a success in McLaren Vale. And, your dad won the Jimmy Watson trophy, big trophy, back in 68 with a Cabernet. Do you think that Cabernet is a little underrated in the region and should be regarded in the same light as the Cabernets from Coonawarra and Margaret River? Is McLaren Vale Cabernet something amazing? I think it can be.
It is, absolutely. And just to correct you, it was the 1968 Cabernet that won in 69, but anyway, because it was a one-year-old Cabernet. And my father tells me all the time that I'm not a very good winemaker because I've never won a Jimmy Watson trophy. And I said, if I win a Jimmy Watson trophy, it's the end of the winery because it's still, nowadays they're all actually fairly drink now styles, and so that would be that completely wrong for our wines are all about ageability. Great wine has to age. I mean, you can't. There's no such thing as a great wine that doesn't age for a long time. So anyway, I'm deviating. Cabernet in 1990, before the export boom happened, there was as much Cabernet planted in McLaren as there was Shiraz, and it was the highest priced grapes and the highest priced wines were Cabernet. And so, and whenever Dad walked through the winery, he'd say, "What's that?" I said, "That's Cabernet." He said, "Well, be careful of that. Cabernet, that's Cabernet." Yeah. And in fact, they used to label things Cabernet Shiraz, even if it was actually mostly Shiraz, just because, you know, it had Cabernet at the front. So in those days, there was no label integrity. No one could go back and have a look at what you did. In fact, they'd blend vintages and things like that back years ago all the time. So it was all, you know, cowboy sort of era, you know. Cabernet in McLaren Vale doesn't suffer from the donut effect. It has a little bit richer character, but it has intense black currant, blackberry fruits, sometimes a little bit more capsicum and red earth spice. Sometimes when they're the really red vintages with a really lovely line of fine tannin and a really fragrant, like almost rose petally thing, they can look like, when they're 10 years old, they can look like Barolos or Barbarescos. It's really quite surprising how many people have told me that they've had a Coppermine Road when it's 10, 15 years old, and everyone in the room said, "Oh, it's a lovely Barolo," and then it's found out it's a bloody Darabin McLaren Vale Cabernet. but of course, all the great Cabernet regions in the world have sea to the west, like Napa and Chile and Margaret River, Coonawarra, and McLaren Vale, and there's other Bordeaux, of course. So we've got sea to the west. We're right on the sea to the west. So there must be something in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd never thought about that, but you're right.
There's always a leafiness. I was just going to finish. Yeah. There's always a leafiness in McLaren Vale Cabernet too. You can always get that beautiful edge of green olive or even minty character, which screams Cabernet. And Cabernet has to have that, or else it's just another dry red.
Yeah, no, I agree. Tell us a bit about climate change and how it's affecting your thinking. I mean, you've got all these varieties in the vineyards. Are you planting some grape varieties specifically as a reaction to climate change and what's happening in the world?
Most definitely, yeah, we are, yeah. And look, you know, vintage is about a month earlier nowadays than what it was 40 years ago. And that's the same nearly everywhere in the world. And so we're certainly seeing the effects of it. And of course, droughts are more extreme, and wet weather in harvest is more likely. As the tropics move a little bit down, whatever, there's all these problems that are coming. And the heat waves that are a little bit more extreme can burn the grapes. So we're trying to find grape varieties that don't burn during veraison or don't get upset by heat waves that happen during flowering, and ones that ripen later and have great colour and great flavour and a certain amount of herb like carrot. And so my best two varieties I think that are most suited, that actually have similarities in some ways to Shiraz, is Montepulciano and Menthia. The two that are cropping up as the best really long-aging wines that have all these potentials that I mentioned. But I love also Sagrantino, which we have five vineyards of Sagrantino, which is really fun wine. And that, again, looks like Barolo. I call that wine the Senosilicophobic cat. Senosilicophobia is a fear of an empty glass, and which we all suffer from in this industry. And I had a cat called Booze, whose real name was Non-Alcoholic Booze. So he thought he could drink being called Booze, but he wasn't allowed to drink because he's non-alcoholic Booze. So he suffered from senosilicophobia, the fear of an empty glass, all his life. And so that's just a free run of Sagrantino because it's a very tannic wine, of course, so we just use the free run. But the pressings I keep separate. And both wines I blend 80-year-old Cinso into, just a little bit, just to get a little bit of softness and lift and a little bit of floral juiciness. But the pressings of Sagrantino, that goes into another cat wine called the Arthur Zagorophobic cat. And Arthur's agoraphobia is a fear of being forgotten, and pressings of Sagrantino will never be forgotten. But not only that, but I had a cat called Audrey Hepburn, And Audrey was just an ordinary tabby. So I called her Ordinary instead of Audrey. And she had a complex of being forgotten. A snake bit her and killed her, which happens to all the cats.
Oh, no. Terrible. But as people could hear, you know, you're always fun to talk to. And it always seems like you're having a great time, like you've got the best job in the world. I just wonder, do you ever get kind of frustrated or down on yourself? You just seem to be one of life's most optimistic human beings. I mean, there are moments when you think, oh, shit. You know, I need a break from this.
No, I don't. But I have techniques that have solved that problem. You know, I went to boarding school, and that was an interesting thing to do because, you know, everyone's giving everyone a hard time. There's fights and things. So you know that life's going to be better than that after that. So, you know, if it's a bit rough when you're growing up, that's good. I mean, you can hardly say it's rough. It's boarding school. It's not like I'm on the street, you know. But it's a bit rude of me to say that. But you know, it's still when you're there in it, you know, it's that. But I back in 1987, I learned transcendental meditation. And that actually I practice quite a lot when I need to, and that removes any anxiety and makes you think more clearly all the time. And so I love doing the meditation. All my family does it as well, and they realise how amazing it is for a busy lifestyle. And I was dyslexic when I was young. In fact, my nickname at school was Muddle, and then it was Twisted, and then it was Twisted Beak, and then it was just. With someone turning their nose with a hand, that was my nickname, because I was muddled up or spoke dyslexically. And so actually the meditation removed all that and my Asperger's as well, a bit Asperger-y. We all are on the spectrum somehow a bit, you know, but some more than others. So I think, you know, you're a bit like me as well in that area probably. Although I think you can read and write better than I can.
Let's hope so. I mean, I just wonder, you know, your personal brand, I mean, is so strong, you know, with your hair and your humour and the crazy labels and the loud shirts. I mean, was it ever something you set out to create, or did it just kind of happen organically? Is it just you being yourself?
I think my mother had a fair bit to do with that. She was a pretty zany woman. She had a lot of stories. In fact, she wouldn't even eat a morsel off her plate until everyone left the room because she was talking the whole time. And if anyone would, my father would say, Pauline, you've got to eat your fish. It's going to get cold. And she'd say, shut up, Barry, I'm talking. And so he gave up saying that eventually. And so the only way she would eat is if no one was in the room. And so she was quite a character. And she travelled the world all the time on her own. And was an amazing physio, actually. She was Dame Margot Fontaine's private physio in the height of her career. Travelled all around Europe with her. And so, but anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked. She dressed me in very loud clothes at McLaren Vale Primary. I used to go with a tie and really like mustard coloured shirts or burnt orange shirts and whatever. And then I had lots of paisley and whatever. And so I suppose I sort of grew up liking colour. And I actually think that it's a great hangover cure wearing a loud shirt because everyone around you becomes much more alive and more fun and laughing and whatever. And then it sort of just gets you through any of that hangover. So it's just really only for hangovers, the loud shirts.
Tell me about the Darrenberg Cube. I mean, I've not been to see you for a while, and the cube has been erected, if that's the right word, since I was last there. I'm intrigued by the sound of the Alternate Realities Museum that it contains. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the whole Darrenberg Cube is there as a something to tell the story of Darrenberg and wine and to sell wine, obviously, and with the restaurant and whatever else. And so there's over 100 sculptures of vine in there that are made of junk art. And then there's also Salvador Dali, a whole exhibition of Dali art pieces that are for sale, up to $3 million each. But and they sell. It's amazing how many they sell there. You know, they sold two last week, not $3 million ones, but you know, a few $50,000 ones. But no, getting back to the Alternate Realities Museum. So when we have a glass of wine, you and I, we share the same wine. We have a different reality depending on what we know in wine, what we like in wine. And so there's all these alternate realities with everything that I have in there. Like as you walk up the row of vines, you'll hear the weather, 8 parameters of weather, a little weather station you can see 3 rows over, and it's measuring 8 parameters of weather, and it's changing the sound in real time. It sounds really, really freaky. It's really amazing sound. It's really a beautiful sound. In fact, at night time, it can sound a little bit scary, that sound. But there's a I have what's it called? 3D sort of art, reverse perspective art piece of the winery, which is really fun. Because you, when you walk in, you have to walk in drunk, side by side, working side by side, you'll see the winery move because it's a 3D image thing. And then when you get closer, the back swaps with the front, you actually get a bit dizzy. So I tell everyone, not only did you look drunk, you actually felt drunk as well. And you haven't even had a glass yet.
I seem to be going sober.
And so you know, we've got a cow sitting on its tail, hugging a polygraph with the horns there and all the things crossed out that we can't do, like, you know, fertilizer and whatever, for our viticulture. And we've got the world's first fully automated natural winemaker there. We put grapes in there, we turn it on, and we walk away. A month later, it's all made and pressed. We haven't added anything to it, no sulfur, no yeast or anything. And we sell that. It's called the Obliviscence Reverie. And it's to say, of course, it's a robot-made natural wine, which it's sort of like a bit wrong because you think of natural wine being made by a human and not touched by any machines, but this is still 100% natural wine, and it's just that no humans touched it at all. And so it's quite quick. It defines what is natural wine, really.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Listen, when I was doing a bit of research to chat to you today, I noticed that in 1992, you featured in a list of Australia's most sought after men, which is pretty impressive. I'm just wondering, have you still got it?
Of course. Well, actually, I'm hooked up nowadays, but she hasn't run away from me for 17 years. So I suppose I must still have it. Either that or I'm giving her too much jewellery. But she's a great chick I'm with. But I think I get on well with women. I'm not sure. But it was pretty funny when I did win. It was Clio Bachelor of the Year, one of the Clio Bachelor of the Year magazine. And the night the magazine came out when I was in Adelaide, all these women were come up to me. It's like Alvin Purple. You ever seen Alvin Purple? He gets chased by women all the time. He doesn't really want to be with them. And this woman, she wasn't particularly attractive, said, "I've just been lying on bed reading about you." I'm thinking, oh my God, whatever. She chased me around all night. And later on that week, I went to Universal Wine Bar and four girls gave me their keys to look after. And I went home on my own drunk. Not completely drunk, but you know, I had all these keys. There was only one with a phone number on there, and it was Bolt's Cafe's gates key. And they said, "How have you got that?" And it's also quite quirky humor, was at the end. I don't get keys given to me anymore.
I mean, you know, listen, when I came over to celebrate the centenary of Darrenburg in 2012, which was a memorable couple of days, the wonderful tagline was 100 years, 1,000 stories. I mean, you've given us so many great stories. Do you have a favourite Darrenburg story? It could be about Darry, it could be about you, it could be about the winery, anything, or the growers. Is there a favourite story you've got from those thousands?
Well, there's millions, but there's one that I like talking about because it's pertinent to the English. And this English gentleman came into the tasting room many years ago. It's a pretty shitty tasting room too, by the way. It was all fake vinyl floor and fake wood paneling, you know, that 1 millimeter thick that if you leant on it would break. Anyway, in the old shed there, I'm talking in the 70s, and this English gentleman came in and said to my father, "How dare you call your wine Burgundy?" Because, you know, the Darry's original was originally called Burgundy. Everything was Burgundy, claret, port, you know, hock, champagne. "How dare you call your wine Burgundy? What audacity do you have to call it Burgundy? It's not even made from Pinot Noir." And my father said, "Well, you know, the Barossa was settled by the Germans and McLaren Vale was settled by the English. And the English called the wines they made by the wines that they drank at home. And we've been stuck with it ever since." And he said, "Touché." But there's another story where another Englishman came in around the same time, not the same day, but you know, around the same era, and he came in and wanted to try the wine. So lovely, my year one teacher was at the cellar door that day, and she's a beautiful lady, Dulcie Vic, and she was pouring wine for him, and he would taste the wine, and she'd say, "Well, what do you think?" And he wouldn't say anything, he'd just shake his hand as if he didn't like it, and she'd go, "Well, I'll show you the claret," and he'd say, "Okay." You know, he wouldn't say, "Okay," roll it on, you know, with his hand, and she'd taste that, and then she'd go, "What did you think about that?" And again, he'd shake his hand, and then he'd try the Shiraz Cabernet, and the same thing would happen. And then eventually she said, "Well, here, we'd like a straight Shiraz." And he looked at her, and he was quite upset, and she didn't know what to do, you know. And so she just pours the wine and puts the bottle down, and she said, "I obviously upset you. What did I say to upset you so much?" And he said, I thought you said, would you like to scratch your ass? Not, would you like to scratch your ass? But would you like to scratch your ass? It's, you know, English is sometimes hard to understand, Australia.
Well, and on that elevated note, I think we should end the interview. Chester, it's been, as ever, lovely to see you and chat to you. And I hope I'll see you very soon around the world, or in Australia or in the UK or whatever. Mate, it's been always been great fun.
Tim, yeah, great too. And yeah, hopefully I'll see you soon too.
See you, buddy.
Cheers. Yeah.
What a guy. And you can see what they mean about 1,000 stories. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Rodrigo Soto from Quintessa, in California's Napa Valley. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles, and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.